Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Tonight's the first talk that I've given here this year, and at the Nuns' Monastery we've started on a very positive note this year. We've already done our first blessing at a wedding. It's the first time that the Nuns' Sangha has been asked to give a blessing at a wedding, and it's a sign of the Nuns' Monastery developing and the confidence that people have in the Sangha growing, that we were invited to give a blessing at this wedding of two people who come to the monastery and practice the Dharma. You might have known that last year I mentioned that we had a lot of funerals in the Buddhist society, and that the community at Dharmasara seemed to be, from the middle of the year, attending a lot of funerals and conducting funerals. And so it was a nice change to start off with a wedding instead of a funeral. And it was very nice to be able to participate in the wedding. For those of you who don't know, monks and nuns, Buddhist monks and nuns, don't actually perform weddings. We don't have that legal authority, but we do give a blessing at a wedding, chant some Paritta verses, and also give a talk. And you might wonder what monks and nuns might have to say at a wedding, seeing as some of us haven't been married, and we don't know what it means to be entering into that kind of partnership. But as everything in life, the Buddha has said lots of things about marriage and about relationships, and the Dharma always has something relevant to say about any situation that we find ourselves in. In fact, someone said to me that they thought that the Buddha wasn't very hot on marriage, that he didn't think much of marriage, and they assumed that he didn't have much to say about marriage. But that's, again, not in fact the case, because as you look around, you'll see that most of the people here are lay people. They're not monks and nuns, and this is very true of everyone who practices Buddhism. Most people are householders. Most people are lay people. And the Buddha had extensive teachings for those who were living the lay life, including on marriage. In fact, the Buddha was quite revolutionary for his time and the social conditions of India at that time, because he encouraged people to enter into monogamous relationships and to honour their marriage vows. And this was something which was very uplifting for women, because in India at that time it was quite common for men to have more than one wife, or if they were very rich, to have a wife and then several women that they maintained in either a harem sort of situation, or just as paramours who they had access to as according to their pleasure. And so women were very often at a disadvantage unless they were from very wealthy families or very high caste families. And so the Buddha encouraged relationships of mutual respect established between partners, and that one of the things that the Buddha, or one of the ways in which the Buddha defined the keeping of the third precept, which is not to engage in sexual misconduct, was that men should not go with other women, with other men's wives. Specifically stating that this precept was an injunction against committing adultery and against going with women who weren't their own wives. So the Buddha, as in so many ways, was really very sympathetic to the difficulties that females often faced in the situation of the day. And when we come to look at the teachings which he gave specifically on marriage, one of the things that is very noticeable is that he addressed marriage as a relationship between equals, and that even if they weren't equal in terms of the social status of men and women, that in their relationship there should be an attitude of mutual respect, and that even though in social conditions women may not have had all the advantages, freedoms and rights of men, that they should still be accorded special status within the household and given responsibility over the running of the household, and even responsibility of looking after the wealth of the household. There wasn't a sense in which he said that women should be excluded from positions of power in the household, or that they should be completely dependent on the goodwill of their husband. Once they married, that they should be a full member of the household and fully engaged in running the household. And if you know anything about the social conditions of women in India traditionally, even today, it's the standard practice that women go from their family of origin to their husband's household, and that household very often is an extended family situation where there are more than one female head of the household. And the Buddha, in expressing his concern that wives going into a new situation, going into a household that was already established, should be treated with respect and should be given a position of responsibility, this was quite a challenge to the established norms of even today. So just to mention those things so that you understand that the Buddha in fact was not had a very positive approach to marriage, and also to the relationship between husband and wife, which included a very a positive attitude towards the female in that situation. In terms of marriage, it's, I think, quite important to understand that marriage is very much like any relationship that we enter into. The things which make a good marriage also make for good friendships, also make for good relationships between people in work situations or in any kind of relationship. And that's why the things which I'm going to say tonight are just as important for monks and nuns, because we live together in communities very often with people that we don't know. We don't choose to live with people who come together in the monastery. We might be living with people who are quite different from us, from different backgrounds. And so the establishing of good relationships is very important for us in that situation, just as it's very important in marriage. When I went to do the blessing for the first time, I was wondering what I should do because I'm not very experienced in blessings. And so I took a leaf out of Achyam Brahm's book. And those of you who've been to wedding blessings with Achyam Brahm know that he's got a whole list of standard stories and standard jokes. Sometimes they're standard jokes whether it's a wedding or a funeral. They seem to pop up, doesn't matter what the situation is. But he has one joke about that marriage and weddings are to do with three rings. And I didn't dare tell that story because most people have heard that story about the three rings, that there's the engagement ring, the wedding ring, and then there's the supper ring. But I didn't dare tell that one because I thought, someone sure to have heard that somewhere. I'll start off with another story. And the story that I started off with at this wedding was the analogy that Achyam Brahm gives about people coming together in a marriage, in a partnership. That we have this romantic, idealized notion that when people are united in marriage, that they become one. One heart. One mind, working together, all the differences just disappear. That's the romantic notion. But in fact, it's more like creating something huge, like an elephant. Instead of having one heart, one mind, you've got two minds, two hearts, two sets of ideas, four legs instead of two. Four arms instead of two. You're creating something huge with a lot of potential for good or for damage. Just like an elephant. An elephant that is well trained and is restrained can accomplish so much, can lift huge weights, can get through lots of seemingly endless tasks. But an elephant that isn't restrained and isn't well trained can do damage just by walking around. And this is like the relationship in marriage or in any close relationship. There's tremendous potential for doing something bigger and better, greater than one person or two individuals can accomplish if they work together, if they work as a team. Family life can become wonderful, a blessing for not only the couple but also the children, the extended family, the community. This is what happy communities are built on, happy individuals coming into happy relationships, families, and the happiness extending outwards. But we also know that marriage, close relationships, if they aren't entered into skillfully, can really create havoc and hurt not only the individuals, but the people in the family, the people around, everyone. Unfortunately, we've seen just recently in the newspaper today the situation of someone in a family killing the people in the family out of anger, presumably, jealousy, whatever. So we can see the tremendous harm and damage that that elephant out of control can do. And in the story that I was telling at this wedding, building on this image, there were a lot of children at this wedding, so I was trying to make it something that they could relate to. But I think it's useful when we're thinking about what marriage involves. I was telling of a story of a situation that I encountered when I lived in Sri Lanka. There was a festival happening in the town, and a lot of elephants had come to participate in the festival. And elephants, you may know, only like to eat particular foods, and some foods are considered staples, but others are considered treats, real sweets. And when all these elephants came to the town, it was hard to find enough for all of them to eat. But so happened that the house next to us had a particular kind of palm tree that elephants just love. And it's not a staple, it's a treat. And so people who were organising the festival went to the householders there and said, can we come and bring our elephant to eat your palm tree, because it's a real treat for the elephant. And the people in the house were very pleased to think that they could participate and do something like this, extra special to have an elephant come into their garden. But it was explained to them that once the elephant came to nibble on their palm tree, he wouldn't just nibble on the bits of the palm tree would be gone. It was, an elephant after all. It was coming to eat the whole thing. Were they willing for that to happen? Ah, yes, yes. Well, once in a lifetime opportunity, we'll give up our palm tree. Bring the elephant. And so we waited excitedly for this huge elephant to come along. Here it comes. But how's it going to get in? The gate is not made for elephants. This was the house, this is in the village, not cars and driveways and that sort of thing. Simply a small gate that no big elephant, let alone a small elephant, could fit through. Ah, do we really want the elephant in the garden? Yes, we do. And by this time the elephant could smell that there was one of those kinds of palm trees in the garden. And so the elephant certainly wanted to come in. How are we going to do that? We have to take down the fence, won't we? Are you willing to dismantle your fence so that this elephant can come in? Dismantle the fence, take it all down. Just if we want the elephant, that's what we have to do. Okay, so everyone gets together and dismantles the fence. And now the elephant's ready to come in. But of course, elephants don't do tiptoe very well. When an elephant tries to walk in to the garden quietly, even a restrained elephant, even a well-trained elephant, anything that's in the way gets trampled on, even before they get to the palm tree. Are you willing to have your garden dismantled, not only the fence but the garden? And so the people had to decide, yes, 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 we really want the elephant to come in. And so they took down the fence, and in came the elephant and walked and trampled all over the garden to get to the palm tree. And of course, when you pull up a palm tree, you don't just gently pull it up in one place. You thrash it about and you knock over the things that are around it, and you have a great time if you're an elephant. And so after the elephant had been, you can imagine the damage that was left behind. Now this, I think, is quite relevant to the idea of what happens in a marriage, in a relationship, when two people have to decide just how much they're prepared to give to that relationship. How much are they prepared to give up in that relationship? The elephant, if it wants to eat the sweet fruit, which it likes, is going to create some damage. So the sweet fruit is like the happiness of a well-established relationship, and a relationship which flourishes. But for that relationship to flourish, the barriers have to come down between the people who are establishing that relationship. It's a whole new ball game. It's not a matter of just squeezing it in, fitting it through the gate and keeping everything as it was before and hoping that it's going to satisfy. It takes a tremendous commitment to enter into a relationship of marriage. And so taking down the barriers between the husband and the wife, being willing to let down their boundaries, this is a very important aspect. And then even if the elephant is well trained and restrained, it's always going to be different than you expected because, as I said, elephants aren't good at tiptoe. And when you come together in a very intimate relationship, there are bound to be things which are required of you, which you weren't expecting to have to give. Parts of yourself that you weren't expecting to have to reveal. Parts of yourself that you weren't expecting to cause friction. Maybe parts of yourself that you didn't realise you actually had to offer to the relationship. So there's going to be all sorts of new discoveries, just like making the new path through the garden to get to the palm tree. So when we consider what's required in a marriage and we have this image of the elephant, it helps us to see what a serious and massive undertaking it is to enter into this kind of relationship with another. And in terms of the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha said that one of the highest blessings in life is when a husband cherishes his wife, when a wife cherishes their husband, and when the husband and the wife cherish their children. And this word cherish really indicates what we're talking about when we enter into this kind of very deep relationship. It expresses both the attitude that we have and also how we go about approaching and developing this relationship. When we talk about cherishing something, it means to tenderly care for, lovingly look after, protect and safeguard something that we hold dear. So the relationship is something that we hold dear, that we value. And because we value it, we're willing to give it our loving, tender care and attention, to establish it, to nurture it, and to allow it to grow. The Buddha, as I said earlier, gave as a foundation, a starting point for marriage, mutual respect between the partners. And as I said, we're not just talking about marriage. If it's a same-sex relationship, if it's a friendship, if it's a partnership of any kind, mutual respect is the foundation for that relationship. Mutual respect, what does that mean? It means that we value the other person not just in terms of what we can get out of them, what they can give to us, how we want them to be. We value them for themselves. And obviously when people come together in a relationship, there are things which attract, things which lead to a sense of compatibility. These things we get on well with. These things we are alike with. We see things the same way. We have the same interests. I like the way they look. I like the way they walk. I like the way they sound. Many, many different levels of compatibility. But there will always be things in which we're different. Things where we don't see eye to eye. Things where we don't agree. Things we don't like. Habits, tendencies, attitudes. And entering into a relationship of mutual respect means that we allow all of those things, both of those things, the places where we come together harmoniously, but also the places where we don't. And it's interesting to just reflect that the Buddha said this is the starting point, this mutual respect. And sometimes we can kid ourselves that we've established mutual respect when actually we're just waiting for our opportunity to change the person so that they become the way we really want them to be. The idea that when I've got them and got them the way I really want them to be, then I'll really love them. Then they'll really be mine. Then I'll really be happy. Now, if you're already married, it's too late to think in those terms. But we can now ask ourselves, how often is it that we enter into a relationship with someone with the idea that we'll fix them up, or we'll change them, or they'll be better after we've through with them? And this is very important for us to consider, because it works the other way as well. When we enter into relationships where we think that the other person is going to fix me up, the other person's job now is to make me happy, the other person's responsible for my well-being, this is a lack of mutual respect, but it's also a lack of respect for ourselves. And this again is a paradox in the Buddha's teaching, that whenever we're talking about relationships and moving out to engage with other people in a deep, heartfelt way, we always have to look at ourselves first of all. Where are we coming from in this relationship? If we want to establish a relationship of mutual respect with another person, do I have self-respect? Do I hold myself as valuable? Not for what I can do, or not for what I can give to others, but just for who I am. And do I honestly know my strengths and weaknesses, so that I'm not trying to sell myself as perfect, or feeling that I'm hopeless and someone else is very good just to even be nice to me, just to want to be my friend because I'm so hopeless. When we have this kind of attitude and we enter into relationships, we expect unrealistically that that relationship is going to complete us. Each one of us is responsible for completing ourselves. And this is fundamental to the Buddhist approach. So it's not only respecting the other person and seeing them strengths and weaknesses and working with that, but also looking at ourselves and our attitude to ourselves. This is the starting point. And one of the attributes of a successful marriage, the Buddha says, is when partners can work together to help each other to grow, to learn, to be willing to acknowledge where they need to change. Not for the other person, but for themselves, and to help each other to do that, to give the support that allows people to learn from their mistakes, to learn how to do things differently, to see if what they're doing or how they're living doesn't bring happiness. How can they do it differently? How can they work together for their mutual satisfaction? And this, as I said, comes back to this idea of mutual respect and a relationship of equals. With mutual respect as the foundation, the cement for any relationship is trust. And trust, like so many other conditions, is something that grows. We might have a feeling of trust and confidence in someone, and obviously if you're going to enter into a marriage, there's a certain level of trust already established. But as the level of intimacy changes and grows, develops, then also the trust needs to grow. And this is a cementing force not only in intimate relationships, but in all our relationships. And what does trust mean? Trust has this sense of having a firm belief that this person means what they say, that they're predictable, that they're authentic, that how they are today is how they're going to be tomorrow. Now, we all know that things change, but to have this sense that there's going to be some predictability about their behaviour, some authenticity, how they say they are is how they actually are. What they say they do is what they actually do. And when we're establishing trust, we watch to see whether we can really have confidence, really rely on this person over time. And this is, as I said, not something that is fundamental just in personal relationships. In the world of economics, establishing trust with customers is one of the fundamental principles of success. One of the key points for selling one's goods is that consumers have trust, confidence in the product. And one of the things that keeps people coming back to the same company, the same product again and again, is product loyalty, brand loyalty. And interestingly, as economics becomes more global and companies try to break into new markets, for example, if American companies try to break into the European market, they find that the biggest hurdle that they have to overcome is that the consumers have loyalty to the brands that they're familiar with, the things that they've known for many years, the things that they have been able to trust and rely on. And the thing that the new companies have to break through is that sense that you can trust me. Our product is just as good. You can rely on us. Our service, our after-sales service is just as good. The products are very much on a par. But to get people to believe that their product is as good and that they care as much about their customers, this is the hurdle that they have to overcome. So establishing this trust is very important, even in the field of economics. What to say about personal relationships? So trust grows out of predictability, reliability, honesty, authenticity, living up to one's commitments. And again, these are things which are outlined in the five basic precepts which lay Buddhists take. The precept of abstaining from sexual misconduct, the precept about using honest speech, the precept about taking what's not given, these all have the element of trust in them, that this person is how I assume them to be. What this person says is what they do. But even more than that, the first precept of harmlessness, not deliberately harming any living being, has a strong element of trust in it. We trust each other that no one here is going to come up and hit me on the head, that we can come together in this environment without violence. We come together without the sense of having to be afraid, on guard. And this is just coming together with people in a meeting. What to say about intimate relationships where you are letting down the barriers and opening up new pathways to your heart to someone in an intimate relationship. This sense of this person is not going to harm me. This person I can trust leads to a lack of fear, an absence of fear in that relationship. We know that many people actually exist in family life with fear as a constant companion, fear of violence, fear of neglect, fear of harsh words, and how much damage that does. For a relationship to flourish, to grow, this absence of fear, this confidence that this person will not do anything deliberately to harm me, is so important. And in fact, recently I was listening to a talk by Achan Manindo, who's a monk who's given talks here. He's the abbot of Harnham Monastery in England. And he was talking about the absence of fear is love. This is true love, when you can open yourself to someone and there's an absence of fear. And if you contemplate that, if you can contemplate it in all the relationships that are important to you, even if you think about your dogs and your cats, there's this mutual understanding that we have nothing to fear from each other. This animal is being that I'm going to look after, and the dog responds to that. There's no sense of harm or sense of fear coming from you to that being, and from them to you. And so in intimate relationships, this trust that's established and this confidence that this person will not do anything deliberately to harm me leads to love. Now, as I said, trust is something that grows over time, as we see over time that this person can be relied on. We often hear the phrase these days, people falling in lust, not falling in love. And we can contemplate this, that the beginning of relationships very often based on superficial attraction and things which don't have a lot of substance. The substance has to grow over time, has to develop, so that that attraction, that physical attraction, develops into something much deeper, develops into love. And love really is something which is shown over time, just as trust develops over time. And couples may have come to that point before they marry, if they've had a relationship for some time before they marry. But generally speaking, these are things which don't happen overnight, because they require us to, as I said, let down the barriers, to be free of fear, and to be willing to open up new pathways in our relationship with that person. So once this is established, this foundation of mutual respect, this cementing with trust, which becomes love, then it's possible for people to really work together, and to work together not only for their own benefit, but to more and more see that as they work with the person that they're relating to intimately, that it's for their own benefit as well. So this working together, which comes from the barriers going down and starting to feel as though you're really on the same wavelength very deeply, this is where the elephant starts to become more the idealized idea of one heart, one head. This is when the elephant really starts to be restrained and well trained. And part of this respect, part of this love, is to look to the other person's needs, what would be helpful for the other person, and not to demand more than that other person can give, or not to demand just what we want. This is a bit of a shift from thinking that we'll make the other person the way we want them to be and then we'll both be happy. It's really allowing the other person to be who they are. And as we develop this kind of intimacy and this kind of depth in our relationship, it becomes possible to sacrifice for that person, to sacrifice for the relationship. And these are all qualities that the Buddha mentions as signs of deepening the relationship. The sacrifice we're talking about is not the idea that I put myself down so that you can be up, so that you can get what you want. I'm not worth the best. I'm not worth any more than this. You're more important. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about starting to consider what is beneficial for each one is actually beneficial for both. And sometimes one party will be in the centre of things, and at other times the other person will be at the centre of things. Again, this is a relationship between equals. And if you look at your relationships, your intimate relationships, if you're in a marriage that has developed, you'll see how joy arises at the prospect of being able to give to the other person what they need when they need it. Joy arises at their success, at their happiness. It's not something that is just for oneself. And this is a wonderful thing to see, that in families, in friendships, people are joyful in the success of others, share in the happiness of others, even if they're not the one who's directly had the good fortune. And this, of course, is the quality of mudita, one of the purified emotions, which the Buddha said is not easy to develop, to really rejoice in the good fortune of others without thinking, I wish it was me, or they always get it, or I don't know what they've got that I haven't got, it's not fair. But to wholeheartedly rejoice in their success and to see that it gives a feeling of happiness to oneself. If a relationship develops and evolves, this is one of the signs of that depth, that there is this genuine sharing, genuine rejoicing in the success of the other person. But this again takes time to develop. And the last condition which the Buddha mentions as being one of the fruits of a good relationship, not even just a marriage, but any good relationship, is the ability to forgive the mistakes that we make. If we know that the person that we're married to or that we're in a relationship with really would never do anything deliberately to harm us, we know that when they do, that it's out of ignorance, it's out of not knowing, it's not out of a deliberate intention to inflict pain. But if we look at our intimate relationships, we can see sometimes we even do have that sense of wanting the person to hurt like we do, or to be upset because we're upset, angry because we're angry. They can't get away with it this time. That sort of feeling. But even when that arises in a relationship where there's real mutual respect, a firm foundation of trust, love, becomes possible to forgive even those times, even that kind of behaviour. And sometimes we think that forgiveness is something we should all be able to do, as though it's something that we can just manifest when we want it. But like every other positive quality, it's built up out of various causes and conditions. It's all the other ingredients that we put into our relationship. It's all the times when we look honestly at our own behaviour. We're honest with ourselves about what we do, how we think, what drives us, so that we can look honestly at what it's like for someone else. And when we see our own strengths and weaknesses honestly, it makes it possible to see the other person more honestly, more clearly, without expecting that they're always going to be the way that we want them to be. So forgiveness is again something that doesn't come easily, doesn't come in the early stages very often. It comes out of this deepening of the relationship between people. And if we've been able to establish all of those conditions in the relationship, then it's likely that we're able to weather out the inevitable storms that come with intimate relationships. If a family is happy, if the relationship is well founded, particularly the relationship between husband and wife, partners, then the people that are around them, the children, the extended family, are likely to also be happy and to prosper. If that relationship is rocky, if it's not well founded, then it becomes quite difficult to establish stability and peace and happiness in that group, the family group. And so the Buddha encouraged people who enter into marriage to work on it continuously throughout the course of the relationship. Just as we need to work continuously for our own well-being in developing our own mind and our own individual path of practice, so we need to recognise that our significant relationships, particularly intimate relationships, just cannot succeed, will not continue to grow unless we give them our wholehearted attention. And this is again something to contemplate. As I said, to cherish a relationship means not only to hold it to be dear, but to tend it lovingly, to protect it, to safeguard it so that it can flourish and grow. And in order to tend things lovingly, we have to really give it our full attention. It's not so much a matter of how much time we give, but what kind of time, the quality time. This is a phrase which we hear very often, quality time. But particularly if we're practicing meditation, if we're developing mindfulness, we know the difference between really paying attention to what we're doing and doing it half-heartedly, doing it in a distracted way, doing it without really giving it our full attention. So we have the advantage over people who don't practice to know what it takes to give someone our undivided attention and what it feels like when we can do that, when we can surrender anything else, what's going to happen in the future, what happened last night, what we've got planned for just this moment, and to enter into that moment wholeheartedly. To be able to do that with the person that we're most intimately involved with can be a tremendous blessing. It can be something that nourishes the relationship without having to do anything more fancy than that. Just to give our undivided attention to that person and to be with them wholeheartedly. So contrary to some of the ways that people look on the Buddha's teaching, that the Buddha wasn't very interested in marriage or didn't have much to say about it. He actually gave lots of teachings about marriage and emphasized how important it is for the well-being of the people in the marriage, but also for the well-being of the people with whom they share their lives. So may this teaching that you've heard tonight be of benefit to all of you, whether you're married or in an intimate relationship or not. All of us are in relationships with ourselves and with others, so may this teaching be of benefit to all of you, and may it help us all to attain Nibbana. Does anyone have any questions or comments that they'd like to make? The question is that this week the hottest topic is depression, and can meditation help to overcome depression? It depends what you're talking about with depression. People become depressed because of circumstances in their lives going contrary to their expectations or hopes, but also people can have a more chronic sense of depression and lack of enthusiasm for life, which isn't necessarily tied to one particular incident or episode in their life. So the Dharma can help to address our expectations about life and give us a more realistic understanding of what life contains, so that we don't get quite so bowled over by the things that we don't like that happen to us. And as we cultivate the path of practice and especially cultivating goodness, wholesomeness, that makes the mind stronger. It makes the mind able to hold its seat better when the waves of unsatisfactoriness in our life wash over us. So there are tremendous benefits in cultivating this path, and meditation helps us to become more familiar with our own mind, to see the way moods arise, what triggers them, that they are always the product of various influences, causes and conditions, that they change, that they don't last forever, that they pass away. So practicing meditation helps us to become more familiar with the mind, and also if we are developing depression, to be able to catch it before it becomes overwhelming. And because we've cultivated goodness, it helps the mind to be able to get a more balanced view of things. Yes, there are unhappy things, there are disappointments, but there are good things as well. Having said that, once someone is suffering from depression, meditating can be more or less helpful depending on the kind of mind with which they entered the depression. During depression, if you try to meditate, the mind can be very flat and it can constantly throw up negativity. So when you sit to meditate, you're just anxious and just aware of anxiety, or you're aware of flatness, or you're aware of lethargy, or you're aware of feeling miserable. And so if you haven't got the skills and the strength of mind, meditation can be counterproductive, because it makes you moment after moment after moment concentrate on negative mind states. So one can't give a blanket assessment of whether meditation is always beneficial. It depends on the causes and conditions. It depends on the stage that someone is at, and it depends on what has triggered the depression in the first place. But certainly doing good, being helpful, staying around people who are positive, people who are loving, people who are kind, continuing to be involved in positive activities, helpful activities, those things are beneficial to someone who's depressed. And I think one of the things that we all learned, I hope, this week is that depression, like every other mind state, can happen to anyone. And depression is the result of multiple causes and conditions, things that we are aware of that are happening right now, things that have happened in the recent past, things that we can't even put our finger on, which according to our understanding could even be things from previous lives that we are receiving the fruits of right now. But whatever state we're in, it's always the result of multiple causes and conditions. And if we start to identify the things that we can recognise, then we can do something about them, taking the whole solid mass apart, strand by strand, and dealing with each strand as we become aware of it, is one of the most skillful ways of tackling depression or any other difficulty that we encounter.